Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Happy weekend, friends, and welcome to the podcast. Follow us on Spotify right now and you'll get this every single week. It's a selection of my favourite chats from the last few days. It's a warm ear hug for you. On this week's podcast, it's Busy Busy, Aidan Turner and how he copied his dad's walk to play a boozy chat show host. Adrian Childs tells us his adoration for Jacob's cream crackers. Stanley Tucci hates Andrew Scott. And we celebrate Black History Month with two TikTok singers. We begin the podcast with Aidan Turner, who was in studio live to tell us about Rivals. It's a new 8-part drama on Disney Plus based on Gilly Cooper's best-selling Bonkbuster books, set in the 1980s with tons of brashness and unabashed sexuality. Aidan told us about visiting his friends and family at home because he lives in London now with his American wife, actor as well, and their son. And he talks about the madness of the tabloid fame that he suffered through all those years ago. Next up then, our conversation with Adrian Childs, your man from the telly in England. We talked about his column with the Guardian newspaper, which has hit a lot of nerves from time to time. Sometimes funny, like when he installed a urinal in his home. Sometimes moving, like describing the death of his father. And many times surprising, like his conversion to Catholicism. You'll enjoy that, because we did, and there were many, many fans among our listeners, and we put their texts to him live on air. After that chat, Stanley Tucci, who's now as famous for his interest in food as his movies, for the year in which he made the Robert Harris movie Conclave in Italy, coming to cinemas in a couple of weeks, he wrote a book about what he ate, and we chatted about that. And at the end of the podcast, a lovely conversation to mark Black History Month in Ireland. We met Femi from Raheny in Dublin and F.A. from Tala, who told us all about their dreams of music fame and success after they were selected by TikTok. And F.A. told us that her family won't acknowledge her music career until she's actually on stage performing with Beyonce, which is a bit mean. And that's everything in the podcast. I'll be back on the wireless as ever next week. RTE Radio 1, 9 till 10 every day. So off we go to the podcast. Rivals is the 8-part drama. It's based on Gilly Cooper's best-selling books about class and a bit of competition as well in the English countryside. It's gonna generated already tons of coverage about its brashness and its unabashed sexuality. It comes out on Disney Plus very, very, very soon. One of the stars, Aidan Turner, plays a fiery, dedicated Irish chat show host on British telly, Declan O'Hara. And Aidan Turner is with us in the studio. Good morning.
How's it going?
I've never seen someone dance into the studio.
I did dance.
Before,
I did. I sashayed into the studio.
I thought living in the 80s world in this programme, you would have went, no, no more.
I'm still not sick of it. I mean, that medley did a lot of work. Yeah, I love it. I love it. It's great.
It's done it for you. Listen, you've played a dwarf, a fella, a wannabe nightclub owner from in a clinic, a psychologist, a British Army officer, a tennis coach quite recently, and now the television presenter. You don't stick to type. That
no,
is for sure.
No, trying to break the mold all the time. But, you know, he's Irish, Declan O'Hara. And my dad doesn't know this yet, but I've sort of loosely based it on on him. I've stolen his memories of his physicality and his and his voice. Yeah, his accent. So it's listen out for it.
Because I'm listening to you, because you do a sort of a version of yourself, your own accent, for sure.
I've done that before in shows, but I think, you know, Declan is from Wicklow, but I was like, I don't know what a Wicklow accent is, and I don't know people from Wicklow, and I don't know how to do this. So I sort of like put a Midlandsy. So my dad is an Athlone man. So
is that right? Okay.
Yeah. So it's just, it's kind of richer and it feels weightier and earthier, and that with a handlebar moustache, and we're back in, you know, circa 1986. Yeah.
And what did your dad do in his career?
He's just retired. He's an electrician. Was electrician. So now he's back in Athlone, and he's working on a farm. He's doing what he always wanted to do. He's growing spuds and tomatoes, and he's a beekeeper, and he's living his best life.
That's
my wife
the dream.
Would say.
That's
yes,
the dream.
That is the dream.
And what did you steal then from him that you're using as Declan O'Hara?
Well, just the way he moves and the way he talks. He's quite a fiery man. His accent, I based it on too. All of my memories of my dad growing up. My dad also rocked out a serious moustache for 20 years. So that was probably part of it too. I'm traumatised from it.
Are you traumatised?
Well, I don't know. I can picture it whenever I close my eyes. Yeah.
That is brilliant. Okay, we're going to look at this character very different. Because he's a very angry and dedicated and serious character.
He is a serious character, yeah. In a world of kind of not so serious characters. When I read the script first, I kind of felt like he is kind of the audience in a way. Like he's us. He brings us into this world and reveals the kind of madness that exists in the Cotswolds. But yeah, fiery. I got to work with Victoria Smurfit, plays my brilliant wife in the show too. I'll see her later. I think we're doing some press things later. So yeah, we just had a real laugh.
It's a mad time. Now, the weird fresh thing about it is that it's kind of going back to where telly used to be. I want to give you this one from the Telegraph review. Dispel any fears that Gillie Cooper's book has been Disney-fied. There are no concessions to the times in which we live now. Everyone commits adultery, smokes like a chimney, they hunt and shoot, people tell off-colour jokes and nobody pulls them up on it. That sounds about right,
yeah.
It's the best thing about the show, I think, watching it.
Right.
It rips apart all the PC ideas that we've had for a very long time and places us in the 1980s.
Really does do that. I mean, I suppose we're looking at it too. I mean, I don't know about Disney-fi, but looking at it with this like 21st century sort of lens as well. You know, it's interesting because we do see behaviours of that time. And, you know, when you watch the show, you think, you know, that still exists. We're still doing that. We haven't made an amends there, but there's lots of things we go, thank God we did. We got the memo on that and we've changed it. So it's interesting to see what we've taken with us and what we haven't and what needs changing and you know, what we can leave in the past, I suppose.
I mean, the casting still remains diverse and they got an Irish person to play the Irish character
and so on. That was smart.
But, it does feel like sort of woke is trickling away there and this show is going to be part of that conversation,
I would say. I'm just excited. I mean, I've been doing press for this for a while and I've watched the episodes and I've spoken to a lot of people who've seen the show, but I'm really excited to see what the greater audience make of this, you know, and how it lands with people and what they take from it.
You've played very recently a lot of intense kind of characters. You're a big bearded psychologist.
Right.
With an Irish accent.
Right.
Suspect,
yeah, yeah.
And 15 Love. And we had Ellie Lilly Highland in with us only recently. Mm. That's a Netflix thing where she accuses her former coach
right.
or something. So was this kind of a release?
It kind of was. Yeah. Yeah. They don't always come along that often, you know, and it's the first thing I remember when I read the script. I just laughed a lot. Like it's a really funny show and the characters are funny. He's quite a serious person, Declan. He takes himself very seriously. He wants to be taken seriously in this world of being, you know, the journalistic sort of thing that he does. And he obviously winds up on a chat show, but it's a fun show and everyone is having a lot of fun in it. And it just, yeah, I just wanted to do something like that. Sometimes you're presented with a thing and you go, I need to be in this. At all costs, I have to be part of this thing.
A lot has been made of the amount of sex in the series.
Right.
Even announcing there are two intimacy coaches involved.
I think there's probably more than two.
Well, that seems to ramp up the expectation, doesn't it, of Gillie Cooper style hanky-panky. I think,
yeah, yeah. There is a lot of sex in the show. Anyone who's read her books wouldn't be surprised at that, I suppose. It feels true to her novels, but also like this, you know, it's not. It doesn't feel gratuitous. That the sex sometimes is funny and different, and there's lots of different types of sex in the show. But it's also it sometimes gets difficult and murky and all the things that sex is too. So I think we cover all of that. But yeah, having. I think we actually had four intimacy coordinators on the shoot, yes.
Okay.
who were worked on a daily basis, yeah.
They were very busy.
They were very busy people.
Yeah, there isn't an episode that goes by without a...
There probably is not an episode
quick
that goes
tonal
by.
Shift towards the bedroom. And Victoria Smurfit, you mentioned she plays your wife. Reunited for the first time, I believe, since The Clinic.
Yeah, I mean, I had to rack my brains. I can't remember. I played in The Clinic a lowly receptionist guy.
You're in 18 episodes of The Clinic.
Really? 18?
Yes, according to IMDb.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. Oh my goodness. But I don't know whether I made it to the first floor to the fancy consultants. I think I was just doing coffee in the reception. I don't know if we ever had a scene together. I have to ask her later. I can't remember.
Right, you'll have to come up with that. Yeah. It's an amazing show. When we looked at the cast this morning, a lot of people who launched their careers.
Yeah,
yourself,
yeah.
Amy Huberman, Chris O'Dowd is in it.
Right.
Saoirse Ronan was in it. Robert Sheehan. Liam Cunningham, who directs two of the
episodes. He directed me in one of the episodes, that's right.
We go back to the clinic.
I know.
Quite a bit in this country, don't we?
We do. It was a fun show. I mean, it's one of those things too, because the turnover in a show like that is so quick. You're doing, I think you're doing sort of like 10 scenes a day. You're covering 20 pages of dialogue. So you need to be on it. It's a great kind of, almost felt like a drama school. You know, you have to be, you learn your lines and you're jumping from scene to scene all the time. And, you know, if you... it's sink or swim sort of territory, you know. So if you can't make it through the clinic, you're bust, you know.
But sadly, Aidan Turner doesn't really remember much
of 18 episodes.
18 episodes.
Wow.
Come here, the Irish character. Now, if we were being very sensitive,
right?
A British set show portraying its Irish main Irish character, sweary, definitely smoking. Yes,
right.
Yes,
whiskey swilling.
Yes,
right.
Loves poetry all the time. Mm. Very angry, hot tempered all the time. Married to a redhead.
Yes,
who has a wandering eye. We'd be writing to the Telegraph now if we were so minded.
Maybe so, but I don't know. Again, it's going to be very interesting to see what an audience, an Irish audience, makes of it. But he doesn't feel cliched to me. It doesn't feel like it's a well trodden road. And we're, you know, I think with Julie Cooper's work and obviously our Dominic, our showrunner, and all of our great writers, you know, they're very talented people and it's very well written. And, you know, they wouldn't let it slide either, you know, if it was cheesy.
He's intelligent.
He's a very smart guy. And yeah, we're not,
Who did you watch to capture chat show character?
There was a lot of people. I mean, some contemporary, some modern people, but I kind of went back to... Dave Allen is great to look at. There's lots of people,
yeah.
But William F. Buckley from The Firing Line, like the older,
really?
Smokier
American.
Yeah, long form, political.
Nice, squeaky chair.
Squeaky chair. People have a lot of, no one's interrupting anybody. Everyone has space and room to talk. And there's just a tone there that I quite liked. And I thought that this is the kind of show that Declan would watch. And so there was tonally, there was a cadence about it that I quite liked. Some of those older ones, American.
Did you watch William Buckley versus Gore Vidal?
Yes, I did. Several times. Wow. Brilliant, yeah.
We don't have...
Best of Enemies is a great documentary about
that
show.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah,
yes.
It's very good.
Intellectual Conversations.
Yes.
Wouldn't get away with it now.
Wouldn't today.
You had a tremendous fun on the show, particularly because the budget seems to be everywhere, and the art design, the department, which are the people who make the props and the fit out of the offices and so on. The details sounds extraordinary.
It was extraordinary. I mean, it doesn't always happen like that. You know, when you walk in, you know, to different rooms, to Declan's office, for instance, the first time I walked in, and you know, you're opening drawers and I'm seeing newspapers and you know, files and different things that are stamped and sealed and dated and, you know, coffee stained, things you will never see in the show.
That's
just
wild.
If they happen to come out. Yeah, the attention detail is quite extraordinary, but, you know, there's a decent budget on the show, and it's also, it's every element. You know, I said to somebody the other day, you know, it's a period piece, but that sort of frowned at me to go, well, it's not quite that thing, but it is, like everything, every car, every piece of carpet, every cup, like everything, a photocopy machine, the pens, it's, you know, there's nothing in it that's contemporary. It's all from that time and it's all vintage.
And they use real vintage studio cameras.
The Ikecami cameras.
So it's really over the top.
It was very over the top. And of course, you can't have supporting artists, which you usually have, you know, acting cameramen to do. It's not, we need to bring in the real guys who are the engineers for the camera. So yeah. I was really into all that stuff. And the footage looks amazing.
And to kind of prepare them,
leveled with magnets, and it takes an eternity. And then they constantly go wrong and they break. I don't know how they did it back in the day. I mean, they were breaking down all the time, but the footage is great and we use it in the show a lot.
But you really did that. They really did that.
We did it for real, yeah. Yeah. It's moments like that you are kind of pinching yourself on set. Yeah.
You're also going, why didn't they just give me the money?
Right, yeah, yeah.
incredible cast, obviously very enjoyable crowd to be hanging about with. David Tennant.
Yeah.
People playing nasty people and so on.
Yeah, David's extraordinary. I mean, he's a real force. I just saw him, he just opened, he's having a busy week. I mean, this show is coming out, but it's also, he's opening Macbeth on the West End. I saw him the other day. It's phenomenal. I mean, he's incredible. But our cast is... quite brilliant. I mean, really lucky, really funny, great people. You know, there's just everyone's bringing it, you know, and it's an ensemble piece as well. So anyone sort of leading the thing.
Yeah,
we're all,
yeah.
There's a dozen of us that are all sharing the time on
Danny
screen.
Danny Dyer. This is
Danny has never been better. He's so funny. Yeah. I mean, people don't know how funny Danny is. He's softy and he's just hilarious, you know.
But very subtly funny.
He's subtly funny, but intentionally funny. He's great.
There's a party nearly every episode. But I gather halfway through shooting, there was a Julie Cooper actually hosted a party.
We had a couple of soirees, yes. I got a slight trauma there. My hands started started to sweat when I heard the birdie song. There's a birdie song scene, and that was the morning after Gilly's night before in the Cotswolds.
Very fitting.
Very fitting, very champagne-y, very drunky, and very straight to set, bleary-eyed. Yeah, we can talk about it now, but it was definitely like almost illegal with the state we showed up to set.
Surely actors of today's generation, it's two bottles of beer and that's...
You would think so, right? This, yeah. I don't know.
There was the something 80s got to you.
The 80s contacted us deep inside, yeah.
England is home now for you.
England is home. London is home. Yeah, that it's funny you say it. You know, it was only the other day somebody was asking me, you know, where I live and what to do and all the rest of it, and kind of worked out that I'm nearly in London as long as I have been in Dublin. You know, it'll be I started traveling to London when I was, I think, 21. Started living there at 22, and you know, next year it'll be it's like 22 years. I suppose
the accent never got in on you.
I don't know where my accent's from these days. It's
definitively Irish.
Is it though? That I don't know. It's wavy.
There's
wavy.
Always an intonation for Londoners. Right. Sometimes, even Roy Keane's been affected.
He's
by,
been
you know,
a bit affected.
English.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I have to keep that in check. I don't want it to get too British. But it's I've been there a long time, and you know, my son and my wife, and you know, there's three of us there, so that is home. You know,
your wife's American, so I don't know if she's Kathleen or is she Caitlin.
She's Caitlin, yeah.
She's Caitlin Fitzgerald.
I know.
Caitlin Fitzgerald would have been
I know. It is Caitlin. Well, actually, I call her all sorts of things, but yes, Caitlin.
And she's from an Irish American family.
She is from an Irish American family. Yeah, yeah. Grew up in Maine. We were there a few weeks ago.
Gorgeous place, I'd say.
It's beautiful. Yeah, yeah.
It's time of year as well.
Very nice. Yeah.
And you keep your privacy, and some of the British papers who've been writing about you in the last week are kind of a little bit snarky about.
Are they?
He's very guarded about his private life.
Right. I don't know what they want to know. But, you know?
They want to know everything because you get randomly photographed on the street still.
Yeah, not often though. When I'm doing stuff like this, it'll happen a bit. You know, they know where I live, which is the annoying thing. So you do see paparazzi around the house sometimes. Yeah, yeah, it's a little worrying. But then, you know, when you're not on the telly, there's nobody there. And but they always catch you on the worst possible day, you know, when you're dragging out the bins in a pair of ratty tracks of bottoms or whatever. But
I take it from the team, you don't have a bad day.
Bless you.
That's what they're saying. And you've managed to keep your son's name totally private. Because
I have. Yeah,
that's obviously a decision you've made.
It is. I wouldn't be gutted if people found out, but you try to keep some things to yourself, and because you know, I don't know why we do it, but I don't know. I suppose no one really needs to know, but if people did, I wouldn't be upset about it. But yeah, I suppose I try to retain these things.
We're just in the age of social media where privacy isn't valued.
I guess it's that. It's like interesting to see. It's a battle against that sometimes too. I suppose just that everyone has to know everything about people, or they get very upset. And I'm a bit anti that. And yeah, and for an actor too, it's difficult. I mean, the more people know about you, the harder the job is. It's harder to convince you that I'm playing this character when I'm on Twitter or I'm on it and you know everything about my life. Yeah. I'm not that good. You know,
we're looking for you in the character.
Yes, and they'll see all the flaws, they'll see the homework, they'll see all the things. So I think I've always felt that if I don't share a lot of these things, then I can fool people easier, you know. And I guess there's a certain amount of truth in that.
You eschew the celebrity of it.
I suppose so.
I mean, look at poor Paul Mescal. He's in the Irish Daily Mail. And it's a whole story about what makes the most handsome man in the world, using Leonardo da Vinci's. It's a bizarre thing, but you used to have to put up with this, where you were in Paul Mescal's world for a few years.
That kind of stuff. I almost saw the same article. Why are they talking about the pentagon of the thing? You're right.
How far away your overall face shape, nose width and length, gap between nose and lips.
Right. Very, very important information. That stuff is kind of, you know, we're just talking about, you know, being a dad and stuff. And a lot of that has kind of disappeared, I suppose, the heartthrobby stuff. Once you're a dad, kind of don't want to know about it. Yeah, yeah.
He's definitely gone.
I don't know. Yeah, he's definitely gone. But this might feel like slightly inappropriate to talk about somebody's, you know, pecs or something when you're a dad. I don't know. It's great. It's disappeared. I'm happy about it.
For some people it has. But that must have driven you mad at the time.
Kind of. I just don't get it. You've just run out of responses, you know. I've always been quite flattered by it, really. But then other people are offended by it, and that I'm flattered by it. And the whole thing it's like a snake eating its own tail, you know.
You've just got along with your life.
You just get on with it, don't you?
Totally grand, you know, in the end. And you've never stopped working, my God.
I've been
between
very lucky.
Theatre and TV.
I've been really lucky, yeah.
Rivals is going to land, I think, in 2 weeks' time.
I think it's on the 18th.
Will you look beyond that then? Is the what you do in these interviews, as Declan O'Hara will know.
Yes.
What's next?
What is next? Well, I'm currently shooting a TV show at the moment. Unfortunately, I can't tell you what it is, which is very annoying. I'd love to tell you. And you, and
it's only Ireland. Come on, you can tell us.
I know, but this is it, right? I'd love to. I'll tell you off the air. It's really cool and I'm very excited about it. But it won't be out. You won't see me on it until, I think, probably October next year, around this time.
Okay, so you'll get to take a... You go make that.
Yeah, I'll shoot that until the end of February in New York. And after that, I don't know. I mean, you get
to disappear away from the media, though.
Well,
don't you?
Which would be nice. You'll have to do a bit of that. And then hopefully, we'll see how this goes. It'd be nice to come back and do more of this. You know?
Okay. Have you seen family and friends and everything back around already?
I have.
You've done the hellos.
The little boy's with me at the moment. So he's with his granny today and they're hanging out and doing all sorts of things. So yeah, I get to see dad tonight. He's going to be at the screening at the Savoy this evening. And I get to see all my pals, all drama school mates and all sorts of people.
Did you apprentice as an electrician with your dad?
I did. It was terrible. It didn't last long. Not
can
good.
You not fix things in your house?
Terrible. Can't do it.
My
dad is so good. You just text dad and he comes over and he fixes everything. He's one of those guys. He's one of those.
He's the fly in.
Yeah. He's the real Declan.
Coming from Athlone.
Yeah.
And there was ballroom dancing.
There was. I didn't think you were going to bring that up.
Oh, yeah.
How did I?
It has to be brought up.
Yes, I did. I danced for 10 years. I competed. I won an All Ireland championship, ballroom championship.
Did you?
I did.
Where was that on?
That was on in Mosny. Every year in the big God, ballroom in Mosny, it'd be on. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God, the 80s.
Really, I know, very 80s. I mean,
so you were brilliant. You won in All Ireland.
I wouldn't say the B word, but I was good. I mean, I was good in Ireland, I suppose. We dance internationally and we do okay, but I wasn't ever good enough to like do it professionally or anything.
I'm now looking, trying to go through your IMDb, your movie database in my head. You haven't done musicals or dancing.
I'm not a singer. No, I'm not. I'm a double threat. Not a triple.
But that can be mimed. Your man won an Oscar for mimed as Freddie Mercury for the film.
Yeah.
But dancing? You haven't danced in a film?
I haven't, but it comes up. I mean, I probably have. I mean, I've forever danced with people on set and spinning people around and doing different things, and it's probably just a matter of time. But I'm sure there's bits in everything. I mean, it's a cool thing to know how to do.
Obviously, it helps when you're inventing a new walk for a character.
Exactly that. The physicality is there. I can waltz into, I'll just waltz into your studio. I mean, look at me go.
That's right.
Yeah.
We've actually seen
it's in there. So, yeah, I mean, one day, I'm actually working on doing playing a character who dances, a dance teacher thing with a friend of mine. So I'm developing a thing, but that's way in the future.
It's one of the forever.
It's one of those. It may never see the light of day. We'll see.
Texter says, listening to Aidan Turner, was a next door neighbour to the Turners. Used to work for his grandfather. Just want to pass on my regards, Paul Coy in Athlone.
Oh, good man, Paul Coy. Bill Turner. Yeah, he was a master builder and. Yeah, I mean, he was on roofs until he was 88. He was banging nails into all sorts of stuff. Yeah, great man.
You know what they're saying around Westmeath now? Just the Turners, great hands on them. I don't know what that young lad, soft hands.
Soft hands.
Listen, it's tremendous fun, as we've enjoyed it, and I've been giving out people in the office trying to spoil bits on them because I haven't seen the whole thing yet. But Rivals is out on the 18th of October, 2 weeks' time. We have to wait.
Weeks.
That's the cruel bit about all the marketing behind this. But enjoy what you continue to do. Enjoy the whirlwind of media, and you'll get to hide again in your acting job. But Aidan Turner, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Good morning.
This is great. Cheers.
We'll bring people back into the 80s now as we let you go. Next guest is a professional oversharer. He's a West Brom fan, alleged Jacob's cream crackers connoisseur, a surprise Catholic, and an OnlyFans doppelganger, basically, or is he the other way around? Anyway, you'll know his weekly column in The Guardian. It covers all sorts of topics, many, many fans across the world, really, because, of course, from across the water here, we look at it. And some of the best pieces have been compiled into a collection entitled The Curious Columns of Adrian Childs, who is joining us now. Good morning.
Good morning. I need to explain the cream crackers business because I mentioned it on the radio. When I start eating cream crackers, I can't stop. But my wife and I were wandering around Waterford one Sunday evening about 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I passed this blue plaque, or what we have called blue plaques here. There might be a different colour there. And it was like where Jacob's cream crackers were invented, this building in Waterford. And I stopped and I broke into a sweat. It was like a spiritual experience for me. I'd come home. And but I mean, I can't have them in the house because when I start eating them, I can't stop. So, but anyway, it's nice to talk about them anyway.
You're on a cream cracker quota, basically.
Yes.
At the moment. That's a good place to start because the book and the columns go from kind of sometimes... I wouldn't call it mindless trivia. Important matters.
Mindless trivia, whimsy is fine, but I kind of end up sort of find thinking, at least hoping I'll find some meaning in the most mundane objects. And some people think I'm mad, and some people agree with me. Like I say, I did one about having a favourite spoon,
yes,
which I do have a favourite spoon, but it's for practical reasons with me. But then someone got in touch, so they said, well, I had a favourite spoon. It was the spoon my mother always served my food with, you know, growing up as a child. And when my mother died, I kept the spoon. And she said, there's so much love in that spoon. And I thought, well, actually, then a mere spoon is freighted with meaning. And if a mere spoon can be freighted with meaning, then anything can.
Inanimate objects. I love the fact that you're kind of rooting around in the drawer. You've 17 wooden spoons, but you'll always go towards the spoon you love.
I get anxious if it's not there. I get that nagging feeling. Where is it? Has my wife thrown it away or something? What's happened? I get seized by panic, and then I find it. Sometimes it disappears for days on end, then I find it again. But you know, it's an issue for me, obviously.
Very emotional man. When it comes to
I can. Idiotic is the other adjective my wife sometimes okay, applied to me. But I can go straight to panic, which is what I tend to do when I can't find the spoon.
You do have some inspired ideas, however, and I'm with you entirely on having your own personal and private urinal in your own home. I mean, what's wrong with this?
It's me and you, mate.
It's no, perfectly
very
normal.
Few people agree. Look, I thought I'd have one because trying to keep this in the best possible taste. But, I mean, toilets aren't ideal for men to wee in.
No.
So I thought, and, you know, it causes the splashes and stuff. So yeah. I thought it's only a considerate thing to do to put a urinal in for myself at sort of, you know, waist height. It's perfect for that purpose and spares the splashing and everything. But it's women. It's women who find it most disgusting. This thing is tucked away. It's a very demure little thing on the wall, but it's caused me no end of trouble. And I was only trying to do the right thing.
Now, I've seen the photograph of it. It looks like yours has a lid.
It has a lid.
Yes,
it has a lid. I mean, that's the kind of accommodation I've made for taste and
that's amazing.
And decency. Yeah.
I thought when I grew up I'd have my own urinal, but I also wanted an electric hand dryer because you know what, I'd be changing the towels, washing.
You know, I haven't had one of them.
Oh,
you know
that's
those like you know those ones which you know where those two jets of air made by Dyson.
Yeah.
My dream is to have an all body one of them. So when you come out of the shower, you just stand in that all over of air. And think what you'd save in towel washing.
You would. And your hands feel so clean after that lovely jet of air. Imagine having your own private one, because often there's kind of a residue from other people's hand washing. If you had your own private one, I don't understand how a man with his own urinal doesn't have the hand dryer.
Well, I think there is a space issue. A urinal doesn't take up much space, but an all-over body jet dryer thing would. But anyway.
But anyway, you move on from, you go from those issues to very, very serious topics, and people are extremely moved. And I found a very moving reading as well about your father's death. And what's amazing is your columns can be quite short and pithy, but you pack so much in there. And your description of your father's death really is something else.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just felt there was a lot to say. I mean, you know, not for a start, he was very ill and very unhappy for a long time. And in you know, the last months and weeks, it became clear he was going to die. And by that stage, it would have been, frankly, more of a disaster if he hadn't died. So I was still astonished by just how shocked I was, even though it was the least surprising thing ever. But, you know, I was really groping around finding ways to deal with it. You know, I'd never seen a dead body and I was 57 and that was my father's dead body. You know, it's mad. And you know, I had no experience of being with people who, you know, as they are dying. Why would I? It's generally only doctors and nurses who do. But, I mean, the sense I've got a couple of very close Irish friends. And, you know, as I said to them, and what I know through them is that you do death a lot better in Ireland. You know, we're just missing something. We're missing something here. You seem a lot more sort of, I don't know, equipped. I don't know whether that's the right word. But
we confront it head on, don't we? Yeah, we kind of
confront it head on. I mean, there was actually it was a Welsh woman who made the most sense to me. She read what I wrote about being with my dad, and she was a friend of mine, this woman, but my age, and knew my parents.
Yeah.
And she's a nurse, and she said to me, you've got, you know, I was talking about how horrifying I found it to be with somebody who was dying. And she said, no, it's a privilege to be with somebody who's dying. And it was one of those thoughts that completely, I just realized I've been looking at everything through the wrong end of the telescope or the wrong way around. You know, I just thought, yes, she's right. To some extent, just try hard though it is to see it as a privilege. If you're with somebody as they're coming into the world, then you'd say it was a privilege when they were born.
Yeah.
But to be with somebody when they're going the other way, when they're leaving the world, you've got to see it as a privilege. Now, I just wish I had this incredibly sage and kind bit of advice, you know, before I went through it.
Yeah.
And I sort of slightly beaten myself up. I thought, God, I wish I'd known that. I wish I'd thought that. I wish I could have just made 1% of it feel like a privilege. I would have made a better job of it.
Can you apply it retrospectively? Can you say, you know, I was there for that moment?
I'm not given to positive thinking, but that is a good little positive spin again. Yeah, I'll try that instead of, yes, I'll try that. And like, I was terribly glad, you know, I was there and so on. But the other thing we have here, it's so long till we have a funeral here. You can wait 3 or 4 weeks to have a funeral.
That's the bit we don't understand from our perspective.
My friend, I've got a very close friend in Tipperary, and his mum died, and he called me just only recently on a Friday morning, and he said, she's died. I said, all right, I'll be there at the funeral. And he said, well, it's Sunday. I said, what do you mean it's Sunday? I didn't even know you could have a funeral on a Sunday. You know, I don't think you can here. Certainly not a Christian funeral. And then, you know, I think it's probably better doing it you know, your way. And you're all sort of geared up to it. And, you know, there's a live feed and everything, you know, so I couldn't get there. But, you know, I was able to share in it.
Oh, I mean, we have blockbuster websites and everything. RIP.ie is... checked every morning by many people in the country to find out who's died so they can go to funeral, which goes on for days. Whereas the Brits, you do tend to just package it up and it'll be 2 weeks' time or 3 weeks' time and we might touch the edges of the big topic, but barely. Was it something that helped you cope writing that piece and thinking about it and publishing this?
Yeah, I mean, it's a privilege. Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's the privilege. It might even be an abusive privilege to sort of put it out there. But then what really helps is then when people say, I got a lot of letters about that, my friend Angela in Wales, who sent that thought to me, and that resonated with a lot of people, and a lot of people have been kind enough to email me and say, like, you know, I just went through my dad's death, and reading that sort of really helped me. And it was just other things that just niggled me afterwards. I didn't write about this one thing till a long time after, when, you know, several months after, but I just, something happened. I couldn't get past it. When I went to pick my dad's ashes up, the woman said, well, we haven't, the ashes aren't ready actually, but we got your dad's watch. And she gave me this watch in a little velvet bag. And I just couldn't get past my sort of shock, if you like, that the clock was still on time. It was still showing the right time and the right date. It just seemed wrong to me that his watch had just gone on. It was like I would have expected it to, you know, sort of stop as a mark of respect or something.
I know what you mean.
I've still got it, and it's still ticking. And I this was in my head at the hot, you know, for weeks and months. And then in the end, I thought, oh God, I've just got to write this down. I've got to write this down. And so I put it in that, you know, I just found a way of writing it. And, you know, and then suddenly it helped, and other people talked about similar things happening. So, you know, that's great, but often it's about just hearing one, you know, writing the thing, the privilege of, is that one thing that Angela said. I think that's such a thought about being, you know, a privilege to be with somebody when they're dying. Then, you know, I can be a conduit between her saying that and then putting it out there so it gets the airing it deserves. So you really, you know, as a writer, you're only as good as what you sort of hear from other people, and you just take it and just sort of put it out there. I don't feel as if I deserve much credit for it. The credit's Angela's. I'm just proud I was able to put it out there.
Yeah. Listeners in touch with us saying, I held my mother the morning she died suddenly and kissed her and told her I loved her. My husband is Welsh, and he said, if funerals were an Olympic sport, Ireland would win gold every time. That's from Maria in West Cork.
Yeah. Perfect. I'm sure they would.
It's the one thing we have over the Brits. We're better at death.
I think there's more than one thing. There's more than one thing, I promise you.
Thinking about death and so on, I presume this helps you with your own mortality, becoming a Catholic and having religious faith.
I don't know. I mean, a lot of people, you know, I was born without really. My parents and my brother are just complete atheists, but I always had this sort of vague sort of belief in God. And I became a Catholic when I was sort of, when I was 39. And then all the cradle Catholics on you said, you know, I instantly became like a cradle Catholic, sort of racked with guilt, rather cynical, you know, hunting around looking for where, you know, you could come in on a sub 45 minute mass on a, you know, on a Sunday. I didn't have this sort of wide-eyed, this sort of wide-eyed sort of deportment of a convert. Do you know what I mean? I converted to becoming a cradle Catholic.
Overnight shame.
I think. Hang on. Yeah. Well, yes. Well, sort of. Frankly, yeah. And almost. I don't know. You know, sometimes you think, hang on, is this making things harder or better? But, you know, my conclusion in the end is always, yeah, it makes things better. It's a bit of a solace. It's a place to go. Yeah, yes, it does. It does. Yes, it you know, it is a great help.
And shock and surprise from your mostly atheist family, I believe.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, they just, most of them thought I'd absolutely lost their mind. And you instantly become sort of interrogated on the finer points of Catholic doctrine. And I think, well, look, this is above my pay grade. You're talking to me like I've just become a priest or a cardinal or something, or I'm the spokesman for the Vatican. You know, just, look, all I know is when I go into mass or I go into a Catholic church, I feel something a bit like peace. That's it. That, yeah, I am not getting into theology with you, you know, and if you think I'm a crank, fair enough, I don't mind. But honestly, just, you know, whatever. You wouldn't if you knew me, you know.
You're there for the faith, not the political ideology from the Vatican.
I'm there for the, you know, exactly. Well, I'm there for the peace, really. And you sort of try not to, it's probably the one thing, ironically, I don't overthink. And then, you know, just overthink. And so it's about what you feel more than you think, if anything is.
Okay. And it sits very nicely with you. You got a huge response as well when you opened up about drinking. Particularly this interesting idea that abstinence to you is not the only answer. Tell us about that.
I just think there's a lot of people like me who nobody thought would have, you know, think of as an alcoholic, inverted commas. You know, they, you know, so I didn't conform to some stereotype, you know, waking up in shop doorways or, you know, being blue lighted all the time. Life's a disaster. But, you know, I'm in that category, you know, very heavy drinker. On the surface, it didn't seem to affect, you know, so I made a television program, wrote a book about it, but I just realized that I was going around thinking, well, I'm not an alcoholic, you know, but hang on the other hand, I can't remember the last day I haven't had a drink.
Right.
And though I never get drunk, you know, when you counted up the amount I was drinking, it was absolutely monumentally. It was like, you know, it's between 50 and 100 units a week.
Yeah. And, you know, two and a half units in a pint, just to give people context.
Yes, yeah. And so my point was, abstinence is absolutely appropriate for some people. You know, for some people, the only way of dealing with it is stop drinking completely. You know, but there is another way. You can cut down. You know, there is a way of doing it. And I kind of proved it, because I drink about a third of what I used to drink. And I'm never comfortable, really, controversially, I suppose, with this idea of alcoholism as a disease. I don't think it's an ism. I think if you smoke 80 cigarettes a day, you're not a smokeaholic. You know, that's not an ism. I think alcohol is a very addictive substance.
Yeah, addiction is a difference.
Well, if you write now, it's addiction. It's a scale of addiction. You know, it's if you're drinking 10, 20 units a week, you're a bit dependent. If you're drinking 50 units a week, you're very dependent, stroke addicted. You're drinking 50, 100 and more, you're highly dependent on it. You know, I just an awful lot of time is wasted. I think people say, well, am I this thing called an alcoholic or am I not? Well, if you're drinking that much, you're drinking that much. Just don't think it, be, you know, it, just don't sort of go sort of beyond that. And I think it is possible to... It is possible to sort of reframe your thinking of alcohol, and just find a way of drinking less. You know, hard though it is for some people, and maybe abstinence is the only answer. But a lot of people do manage to cut down. Also, a lot of people who should seek help from the doctor or from whoever don't do so for fear of being told, "Oh, you just have to stop completely."
They're getting afraid.
You know, I think a lot of people slip through the cracks. Because of that, which I think
people
is a
who
real
do need
tragedy.
Help, as you're saying, yes, because the yeah. addiction is in their family. How much do you drink now, then?
I drink about, I don't know, I think I drink about 20, 30 units a week. I mean, I think that's another problem with the messaging, because, let's say, you know, 14 units a week is you know, the you can't, if you can drink safely up to that amount, but more than that, then it can start to affect your health. Well, I think the problem with in the messaging is that it's like you've got to get down to 14 units. Now, most heavy drinkers will think, well, I can never get down to that, so I just won't bother. Mm. But there are huge gains to be had in reducing from, say, 50 units a week to 40. You will comparatively do yourself more good or less harm, if you see what I mean, going from 50 units to 40 units.
Yeah.
Than you would for going from 20 units to 10 units comparatively, because just the way, you know, the harm curve works.
Okay.
If
you're having 30 units, I'm just, we're doing the calculation, because yeah. units, I always, you need to translate, don't you, first?
Yeah.
A standard bottle of wine is 10 units. I mean, 3 bottles of wine for yeah. one person in a week, I would kind of think that's still quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is probably too much, but you know, a couple of pints here, a couple of pints there. It's
you don't get drunk.
So I'll take. No, I mean, in a way, I'm too good at it. You know, as soon as somebody said to me, this MP I was talking to, he said, well, I was talking to him about this program I was making about drinking, and he said, I don't drink much. I'm blessed with hangovers, which is exactly the way to look at it. Because his hangovers were so bad, it curbed his drinking.
Right.
But with people who are just good at it and just do it, have got no downside, those are the ones in danger. Because, they've got, you know, in danger of you know, of liver disease and the other maladies that can affect you.
Yeah, okay.
You know, so it's, yeah.
I feel like we've covered the Irish interesting topics, death, Catholicism and drinking.
So, yeah, absolutely.
Let's go elsewhere. Bending down on marriage.
Yeah. Well, that came when I first got the column from, I got engaged to do the column 5.5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I just wrote one about, you know, getting older is about becoming less flexible. So I was quite fit. I could run marathons and all the rest of it. But, you know, if I dropped a coin on the floor at home or anything on the floor and it was a Monday or a Tuesday, I mean, I probably wouldn't pick it up because I knew the cleaner was coming on a Thursday. You know, so bending over became a sort of a planned event, you know.
Yes. Something.
If my shoelaces came undone, say, after 6 or 7 o'clock at night, I'd probably just take the risk and leave them undone because I'm going to be taking them off anyway come sort of 11
not
o'clock
worth the hassle.
To go to bed. Yeah, so... And, you know, and I just wrote about trying to get out of my friend's sports car when it stopped at lights, had to get out quickly. And I realised I was so low to the ground, I couldn't actually get out. I had to roll out on all fours to get up. But anyway, the editor of the Guardian, who I'd never met, she read this and liked it and said, I'll come in for a cup of coffee. I thought the column was hilarious. And then, you know, basically, before long, we got married. So basically, if I hadn't had trouble bending down, I might not now be married. Yeah. So good things, you know, God moves in mysterious ways.
That's Catherine Viner, editor-in-chief of The Guardian. I presume people assume now that you've always got the column just because of your wife.
Yeah, yeah. That I'd slept my way to the top, but I sort of inflexibly non-bent my way to the top. I suppose you'd say.
I'm sure that was in the speech at the wedding, I presume.
Yeah, some form of it. Yeah.
You've had other kind of run-ins with doppelgangers and so on. We're going to take a quick break, but it'll only take a minute. So we'll be back with Adrian Childs straight after these. 51551 for your texts. We're getting to the real meat of the interview now with Adrian Childs because you have many people who are doubles who look a bit like you, and it can be awkward.
Well, yeah, I often get people come up to me and say, oh, you know, sort of huge people with big round heads, and they come up to me and say, oh, my mates always say I look like you, and I'm always look, and that's fine. But I just think, blimey, do I? But they always look a bit disappointed themselves to say, for anyone to say they look like me. But then, I mean, the most extraordinary one was on the front page of the Daily Star.
Yeah.
Or it appeared this picture of a bloke standing there in his pants, some fella in Leeds, claiming to make money on OnlyFans by pretending to be me. And, you know, it was bizarre stuff. Like, he would be paid good money to sit and read out my columns out loud while not even that.
Oh, right.
Eating a piece of toast and butter dribbling down his chin. I mean, it was that bizarre. I mean, I sort of slightly squeamishly dug into it. And I can't say it wasn't true, but then I don't think it was true either, but I don't know who would have... I couldn't get hold of the journalist who wrote it. And then later on, the bloke in the picture said he got in touch and said he was some Ukrainian bloke and that he was nothing to do with me. But, I mean, if the story was made up, I mean, it was so bizarre. You got to think, well, it was too bizarre to have been made up. Do you know what I mean? You literally couldn't make it up. It was that absurd.
It doesn't really look like you either.
No. No, but I mean, it does raise the possibility. If times get tough, then, you know, you're desperate times. I might have to do it myself. I can sit there in my pants eating buttery toast while reading out one of my columns. If somebody wants to pay me for that, it's easier. You know, there's harder ways to earn a living, aren't there?
Well, you'd have to eat cream crackers and have the urinal in.
Your cream crackers. All the crumbs. All the crumbs, just surrounded by crumbs. Yeah, you're caught up in my chest hair and everything. It's not a pleasant image, is it?
We mentioned spoons. Inanimate objects seem to have a draw for you.
Yeah.
There are hangers as well, coat hangers.
Yeah, well, I've mentioned... I found this coat hanger in my wardrobe, and it was just a very old wooden coat hanger, and it said my Croatian nan's name, which was Katarina Basic. It's written on it, and that was, you know, she, so that had hung in a wardrobe somewhere, you know, somewhere in Zagreb in the 30s or 40s. And I just thought, okay, it's a worthless object financially, but again, like the spoon, that's sort of freighted with meaning. It's something. And I did write a piece about writing the columns last week, and I mentioned, look, I had loads of correspondence about spoons, but not, I must admit, about coat hangers. And then I've got hundreds for about coat hangers now from around the world. Some extraordinary stories. You know, my dad had this in the US Army in the 30s. This was his coat hanger, and I've always treasured it, and I'm going to give it to my grandchildren, and nothing hangs on it. It's just there in the wardrobe. When we go in occasionally, we see it, you know. So, you know, again, like I can and have taken this kind of thing to absurd levels, but every time I do it, I uncover something else, and then, I don't know, I think it came to partly during lockdown where we all sort of had to withdraw into ourselves. Our worlds became very small.
Yeah.
So we had to find greater meaning in the smaller things around us, and mundane things became important. Like, if you couldn't, you know, suddenly there was no flour in the supermarket and stuff like that. You think, what I wouldn't do for a bag of flour. It's channeling that feeling.
Objects became weighted with meaning, as you say. We've lots of messages. I want to come to them now. Just someone wants to say that for most alcoholics, abstinence is the only path. You make that point. We are dependent on alcohol, and when we start, we can't stop. So we can't start and don't have it in the house. Like yourself,
I mean,
and the cream crackers.
Absolutely, I absolutely accept. I accept that.
Yes, and we have a few on that vein, but that's exactly what you're saying. Just to clarify for people, someone says your man sounds he's pure Irish. Death, Catholicism, drinking, and guilt. Ask him about gambling and tea.
I can certainly do tea. Gambling, I seem to have escaped. Although I had an absolutely brilliant time at Galway Races this year, so. I could possibly draw one in, but I was there sort of more for the crack. And I certainly went over my allotted units that day. But
a big welcome, and I'm sure.
I thought it was fantastic. Yeah.
Loads of people said they looked like you as well. That was we have a presenter who could pass for you, but I won't go into that right now. We had a cherished spoon growing up. We hid it from each other. And so each morning we would look with envy at the sibling who was eating their cereal with the treasured spoon, says Sharon. So, yeah, there's weight and meaning to these things.
Is there a spoon museum? I should start one.
You would be the perfect candidate to be brand ambassador for spoon. Because it's disappointing you didn't end up as brand ambassador for the urinals.
I didn't.
Compression socks.
But then you'd have your name. You'd have your name on a urinal, then, wouldn't you? Which isn't a pleasant. Isn't a pleasant image.
Only if it's in the Tate. Yes. I too toyed with the idea of putting a urinal in our new house, but I hadn't the courage to suggest it to my wife. Says Seamus from Westport. He didn't put the idea to his wife. That's extraordinary. Such as the.
But she would have gone mad.
The visceral reaction.
It was the right move. They might not even have moved in together. They might have given up on the whole idea of cohabitation.
You know, I'm assuming in the timeline of your life that you had the urinal before your.
I did, yes.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I did. So she could.
No moving
that. I said, you know, I've told you, I have come out about this.
There's a prenup agreement just on the urinal.
Yes, there was, exactly, yes. Yeah.
I've listened to Adrian since BBC Radio 5 Live's inception. He used to do a Saturday morning. I remember an item on surnames. The surname Wardrobe came up. Ken Wardrobe, as it recalled.
The only funny one. Enough, I was just telling somebody about that the other day. We did a thing of top 10 footballers with funny names. And we did like Steve Death or Diath, I think his name was. But then I had this brilliant producer at the time, and he got hold of I think it was an ex-Sunderland player called Barry Wardrobe. And we managed to get to interview Barry Wardrobe. He was a real good sport. I think my West Brom had a player called Neil Parsley. We tried and get hold of him, but couldn't. But we did get hold of Barry Wardrobe.
Wardrobe is a real guy. Very good.
Yeah.
Listen, we could chat more, but that person's definitely a fan. His left field irreverent humorous side I much admire. And they will certainly enjoy the curious columns of Adrian Childs. I'm looking at the book here. It looks like a kind of a children's book, to be honest, Adrian. I don't know.
Yes, I think. Well, I don't know if that's what they were attend. No, but look, it's look. Want to see it as for the written by the feeble-minded, which written by somebody feeble-minded, for the entertainment of all
for the adult and the shamed.
Fine.
Yes, exactly.
But it's a good toilet. It's a good toilet book. not for the urinal side of things, but you dip into it. Don't read too much at one go. It can be quite difficult to
get
through.
It's great
five
fun.
Or six at one go. Every time.
We really enjoyed our chat with you this morning, Adrian. So good luck for the rest of the day. I know you're busy. You're back in work very, very soon. Yeah. Thursday and Friday is on BBC Radio 5, and the book is out. Have to go for break. Good luck to you, Adrian. Thank you so much. Bye bye. He's an epicure, an artist, a writer, a mixologist, a fan of Kerrygold butter, of course, and he dabbles in acting, directing, that sort of thing. Stanley Tucci, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Very good to speak to you. People of fine taste, the Cogno Shenty, if you will. They already have some of your books, all of them food related, I believe. This one is a little bit different. It has something extra, doesn't it?
I guess, yeah. This one is about the passage of time, I suppose, and but through the prism of what one eats. Over a period of a year.
So what I ate in 1 year and related thoughts as well. So this year you're working on the film Conclave in Rome, and your main request is a well-stocked kitchen. Was that a surprise to them?
No, I don't think so. Not to Italians. I think they were pretty much okay with it. I just needed the staples to start, and then I go from there.
I was kind of surprised to read, as you describe it, the sad state of Italian film catering. You expect that shooting a film in Italy would have wonderful food on for every whim.
Yep, that's what you'd think. But Italians aren't, it's not, you know, Italians go, they make their food at home or they go to a restaurant. It's not, catering isn't like a thing. Yeah. You have to remember too that a lot of Italian food is made kind of very quickly, right? So it's made with fresh ingredients and it's all made pretty quickly, with the exception of like a lasagna or if you're going to do like a slow roast something. But other than that, it's made quickly and it's served quickly. And it's not the kind of food that sits around for a while.
You can't let it hang around, no.
No, you can't. If you let the pasta hang around, it just gets soggy and gross.
Yeah, yeah, that's a turnoff for sure. You're playing a cardinal in the film Conclave. When you put on the robes of a cardinal, does that, is there a certain power that comes to your mood, to your feeling?
Yeah, there is. It's really interesting. I mean, any costume like that, you know, whether it's a military uniform or or something that's you know, a religious garb, yeah, it changes. It changes you. There's no question.
So no one's going to give you soggy pasta if you're dressed like a cardinal, I presume, and you're on a film set in Italy.
Oh, I wouldn't allow it.
Another surprise for us, for such a foodie and epicure as yourself, you consider soup to be the greatest culinary invention.
Yeah, I do, because it's so simple. You know, you can make soup out of, like I said in the book, out of 2 or 222 ingredients. Yeah.
And everybody can cook soup.
Yeah. I mean, one would think. Yeah. You would hope. It's like water and something, you know?
Your description is almost spiritual, isn't it? You describe soup as life in a pot.
It is. It is, because you would take garlic and put it in a bunch of water and boil it up and garlic soup. You know, I mean, you can do it like, you don't, it is. It's like, it's a thing that sustains you. You just need fire and water and a couple ingredients. That's it.
Well, I think you're speaking to Irish people, because stew is obviously very popular dish over here, lamb stew in particular. It's kind of Irish minestrone in a way, isn't it? The minestrone, the Italians will throw everything into it, and that's kind of what we do.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and that's, you know, I do it all the time at home. I make a minestrone at home, and sometimes I make it just a vegetable version. Sometimes you might put a little, you know, pancetta in it or guanciale or something like that to, you know, get some more protein or fat in there. Yeah, I just think it's the most beautiful thing. And you can have it all seasons, you know, like chilled soups in the summer. I mean, are delicious.
So soup is one surprise. And we're thinking, well, his favorite food ingredient must be kind of truffles or things like that. The humble egg is the perfect food for you as well.
The humble egg. It is. You can do so much with it. And as I said in the book, you know, I like them all different ways. If you think about how many different ways there are to cook an egg, it's kind of endless.
Particularly the omelette, I think, is your favorite, is it?
The omelette is one of my favorites, yes. And I'm not very good at making them, but I like to watch people make them. I was said to someone the other day that the person who makes an incredible omelette is Blake Lively, who makes the most beautiful omelette.
Is she also watching Jacques Pepin on YouTube making the omelette, as you recommend us to do?
She must have.
Because I'm delighted that he doesn't do the flourish of cracking an egg one-handed off the side of a pan or dish. He whacks it off a flat surface and then just sort of prizes it apart, I thought was amateur. Yeah. But it gives us hope. It gives us all hope.
It gives us all hope, yeah.
And also, if I'm in my 80s and making omelets on YouTube like Jacques, I'm putting in fistfuls of salt as well, like he does.
Exactly.
Now, you don't hold back when you find a bad meal in a restaurant.
No, I don't. Although I never name the restaurant in the book. I only name the places that I like. I'll talk about the places where the food was bad, but we'll never mention the name. I don't think that's appropriate.
You won't trash talk a restaurant, but
I will in private. Yeah. But not in the book. That would just be rude.
You're going to get a lot of people on your side on this issue, but saying a restaurant that serves a meal on an oversized, slightly concave, rectangular plate drives you mad.
Yeah. I just want a plate. It doesn't need to be like a sculptural thing. If I want sculpture, I'll go to a museum.
Very good. And you don't want to eat pasta off a sculpture. Very good.
No,
There's so much more than food in the story here. The reminder for you to live rears its head in this book again, because you write that the fear of cancer returning still being very present in your days.
Yeah, very much so. I think anyone who's gone through cancer, and you know, I know quite a few people who have, you're always afraid that it's going to come back. And of course, depending on what your original diagnosis was, you either have a more likely chance of it coming back or a less likely chance of it coming back. But the fear is always there.
And death is on your mind, not just because of that, but because your father and your uncle actually designed headstones for graves at one point. So you have a morbid fascination.
Yeah, I am fascinated by it. And, you know, I see it as like a really beautiful thing. But we spent time in cemeteries because, you know, we were visiting the graves of, you know, family members who had passed away. But also the fact that my grandfather's business was making tombstones. And as you say, my father designed some of them, and as did my uncle. And they were really works of art. And so you know, there was this duality, which was, you know, it was incredibly sad and moving. And yet at the same time, they were really beautiful sculptural pieces.
And art is something you like to do as well as cooking.
Yes. Yeah, I do.
Is it painting mostly? You don't try sculpting, or do you?
A little bit of painting. Painting, drawing, just stuff on a smaller scale. But my hope is that in the next few years, I can start to do some sculpture on a larger scale before I get old to be able to manipulate what I, you know, the pieces of wood and stone and metal.
You don't seem to grow old, is the thing from us watching anyway. But you do really talk about the passage of time in this, you say, because you're saying you've got to the age where you know what 20, 30 years is. And now that you've obviously born in New York, moved to London, was it 10 years ago?
Yeah, a little over 10 years ago, yeah.
Is that where you plan to spend those 20 or 30 years that you think you have left in that morbid chapter?
Yeah, I love London. I love living here. I love living in England. I feel very comfortable here. I feel in some ways more comfortable here than I did in America. I like the proximity to Europe. I love the history here. And so I feel very comfortable here.
And of course, proximity to Ireland. And you've been over and back a few times here.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I really want to go again. We had such great times every time we go there. So I want to go back to Dublin again. The food there is incredible. And I want to go to Dingle again, where I wrote about it in the book. That was just, we have friends who have a house not far from there. I really want to go there again because I just think it's beautiful.
Yeah, and we know you're a fan of the butter here. Have you tried the other things we would claim to be original, like soda bread or
black? Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love all that. I love that. And Irish stews and all that kind of stuff. I love it.
Black pudding. Have you tried black pudding, by the way?
I have had black pudding, yeah.
Very good. Okay, so there is nothing you haven't tried. You have a wonderful variation of famous friends. Colin Firth, obviously Irish people like Cillian Murphy and Yvonne McGuinness, Aidan Quinn. Harry Styles, that was one I didn't expect.
I don't think we expected it either. And it just happened. You know, we ended up sort of spending time in our neighborhood and then he'd come over to the house and we would hang out and then we just became friends.
And he's a voracious reader. Again, I didn't expect to learn more about Harry Styles than I knew from Stanley Tucci's book, A Year in Which You Eat.
Yeah, he's a real reader. You know, my wife, when she was talking to him, she's a literary agent, right? So, you know, she's, oh, you know, there's this book about blah, blah, blah. He goes, yeah, no, I know, I've read it. She said, basically, you know, all the books she mentioned he had read. I mean, he's an incredibly smart, interesting, lovely, lovely fella.
While we're on the subject of Irish people that you admire, you have the most astonishing tribute to our own national treasure, another one of them, Andrew Scott.
Oh, my God. He's so good. Well, I told you, and I wrote in the book, he's too good. It's upsetting.
You hate him.
I hate him because I love him so much.
My God, it's one of the killer lines that if you find out Andrew Scott can cook, you're hurling yourself into the River Thames. That's a bit much now, Stanley.
Not really. Not from my point of view.
Another person, obviously you do love your son. Is it Niccolo? I don't know how you will pronounce
Niccolo. Yeah.
His degree in politics, I believe, but he followed your dream for him, which is into food.
Yes, thank God he didn't become a politician.
Yes.
God, imagine those conversations, how boring. No, not really. I mean, he has a great interest in politics and, you know, certainly what's going on in the world. Mm-hmm. But his passion is cooking. In fact, last night he just did a beef carpaccio with a bit of arugula, olive oil, salt, and parmigiano. It was probably the best beef, which sounds weird because he didn't even cook.
Yeah.
But he knew exactly how to season it and how to pound it out. Like, to watch him do it was really kind of cool.
When that comes together like that, you know you've got someone with talent and that they can do this again.
And he just served it on a big board as opposed to sort of having it on a plate and be all fancy. He was just flattened out on a board and it was just amazing.
And I love how you're still insisting on a regular, despite living in London, where it's rocket. Wild rocket.
Where it's rocket, yeah.
Now, I want to ask you one last thing, please, Stanley, because we all know what you look like. Slim, trim, perfect skin. How do you manage this when you talk about so much food and making martinis and things like that? How are you managing to look like you do?
Oh, it's genetics, I'll be honest.
Okay,
right. You know, a lot of it's genetics, but, you know, I exercise a lot. I exercise like 6 days a week.
Do you?
I don't eat a lot of shit, you know. I don't really snack, and I don't eat sugar. It never sat well with me, even as a kid. So I don't like sodas and all that kind of stuff. I don't go near it because it just upsets my stomach. So what's the point? But I have a very fast metabolism. As I said, the exercise really helps. But also, I think because I went through high dose radiation, that has a tendency to increase your metabolism.
Wow.
So besides curing my cancer, it helped keep me thin.
Amazing. What do you classify, by the way, as shit when you say you don't eat that?
Processed foods, you know, snacky things, you know, sweets, candy bars, soda, all that kind of stuff. I don't like it. I never liked it.
Stay away from it. You like it good and simple, and don't give this man a rectangular plate, whatever you do.
No, please don't.
What I Ate in 1 Year and Related Thoughts by Stanley Tucci. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Stanley. Have a lovely day.
Thank you. You too. Nice talking to you.
Bye-bye. Likewise. Thank you. It is Black History Month. Well, it's a celebration of the African diaspora. It's been running in America and Canada since the 1970s. Their Black History Month is in February. And the only place outside of there that marks it is Britain and Ireland. And it's Black History Month in October. And to mark the month, TikTok Ireland is showcasing leading Black and Irish artists who use their platform. And I'm joined in the studio by two of the artists. We have F.A., who's a Dublin-based bedroom pop artist. That's a
yes.
You're nodding. That's a correct
yes.
Description.
You got it right.
Femi is here as well. He's a music producer, a musician, and dude, I'm assuming, given the messing you've been doing during the advert. Effie, let's get to know you. First of all, you're 24, like Emma Quirk, who we're just talking to.
Mm-hmm.
I understand you were born in Nigeria. You came here, you were a baby.
Yeah, I was 1 year old. So I've been living in Ireland all my life, yeah.
Your memories are all Irish.
Literally,
100%. And where is home now and who's there?
I live in Tala.
Oh, very good, yeah.
Yeah, with my family. So with my mum, my four other siblings. So it's a loud house. It's very loud.
What do they make of your dreams, your four siblings?
They don't know what's going on. I feel like they saw me on Other Voices.
They saw Femi, me on, please, host.
And they saw me on Other Voices a couple of days ago on the television. And they're like, oh, this is what you do. So, they're finally getting it. I feel like it won't really click to like, I have a song with Beyonce or something.
That's the bar.
Honestly,
that's the bar.
The bar is so high.
It's a very mean family.
Yes.
Your typical Nigerian family.
Yeah, literally. Yeah.
And Femi, your home is Raheny in North Dublin,
along the other side
of things.
Yes.
You're 22.
I'm 22, indeed.
And you were quite a messer in school, I believe.
Yeah, I was. I was quite a tosser in school.
That's not an accusation, but this is your own kind of story. But music was the settler, is that
right?
Oh,
yeah, music was a big settler. I had two music teachers that really kind of like shaped kind of gave me a reason that, oh, I love doing this. Because I always had like an interest in music. Then I had my sixth class teacher. His name was Mr. O'Connor. Yeah. I can't remember if his first name was Sean. It was Sean O'Connor, I'm not sure, but he used
He'll always be Mr. O'Connor to
Mr.
you.
Mr. O'Connor to me, yeah. But he was like a traditional Irish player.
Yeah.
So he'd be playing like I think he played the fiddle. Yeah, he played the fiddle or I can't remember. But yeah, I'd always...
And suddenly your brain lit up.
Yeah,
went,
my brain lit up.
This
like,
is
oh
doing
my God.
Something for me.
Yeah, you'd be like on TV when I come home from school and I'd be like, oh my God, I'm going to do that. And then when I went to the first year, I had a teacher called Kira Siu. Miss you. So she was a music teacher and she just kept me out of trouble. She was like, oh, she's like, Femi, you're quite like stupid. Like, you're doing a lot of stupid things. She
sure
didn't really
she
say
did
that
say
word
that.
For word. Like, basically said that to me. Here, come into the music classroom and stay here because you knew I could sing. So, like, that kind of just kept me out of a lot of trouble. Like, I actually started like falling in love with it. I was like, oh, this is real fun. I'll just calm me down.
And what was you learned guitar then?
Yeah, I taught myself guitar on YouTube.
Isn't it incredible the differences teachers can make in your life?
It's actually insane.
Yeah, like it's actually really insane. Like I'm like those two were like I think if I didn't have them, I don't think I'd be doing music. Yeah, it was empty.
And so you managed to get through school there, and you went to BIM, which is very well known a music college in the country. But I mean, did you do a year there that you didn't find it was for you? So
oh yeah, I did like barely of a year and.
Barely, that kind of structured education just doesn't suit you.
No. I was just like, oh, I don't like this. I was like, I kind of like, I just like doing my own thing. Kind of like, I like music. I might as well teach myself. I did teach myself. I was like, let me just see how far I can go with it.
So Kira Steed was the teacher, was instrumental to use a terrible, terrible
Kira
pun.
See you.
Kira see you. Is it? See you. Okay.
S-I-E-W.
And Femi is spelled F3M and 3 I's.
Yes, indeed.
So, what's going on there?
Right. So, my name is Femi, and like, I just wanted the name on Instagram. I was like,
and the problem is, Femi is a very common.
It's a
Nigerian name.
It's extremely. Okay.
It's short for something, is it?
Or so the full name, well, there's different like Femis, like mine, but mine I have is Oluwa Femi, so that's a Yoruba name, so that means God loves me, and like Femi by itself means like to love, or if you want to say like you want to like marry somebody, you just like I'm not really fluent in the language, but from what my mum has been telling me is that if you want to propose to someone, it was like. Can't remember the sentence, but Femi means to marry. Like, so.
Really?
Yeah, by itself. So, by itself, Femi means like, or to marry, or to love.
Stressful name to be.
It's a stressful name.
And that's Mum Ellen, who's trying to get you to learn the language, does she? Or maybe she doesn't.
Oh, no, she doesn't try.
But she's teaching you things.
She's teaching me things, teaching me a lot of things.
F.A., since you've devoted your soul to TikTok, which is where musicians have to go.
Yes.
Where there's no value in privacy in social media, as we know. Mm-hmm. Your life story in terms of music.
Mm-hmm. Me? Wow. I was doing like talent shows when I was younger. I always thought that I'd be like the next Beyonce, honestly. Mm-hmm. And then eventually went to college, kind of like pushed like music to the side. But then hop back in because I was like, I just enjoy creativity as a whole. And then started making music with my best friend. And that's kind of how I started like really making music and started posting on SoundCloud and then eventually posted on Spotify. And it was like received really well. And then it's just kind of all happened from there, honestly.
And what has happened since there?
Oh, a lot.
big followings on social media.
Sorry?
Big followings on social media and gigs, isn't it? And
yeah,
just
a lot
making
of gigs.
Bringing
so,
your music out there.
Yeah. So being able to like tour with like Paolo Nutini, like Still Woozy. Done my own headline show, did Glastonbury and all of that, and like Longitude and EP and whatnot. So it's been crazy, honestly. Yeah,
I mean Glastonbury must have been something else.
That was insane. That was quite scary. Yeah, it was really scary.
Since we're talking about your music, we asked you what would kind of give us a flavor for the sort of thing you do.
Yeah.
You tell us a little bit about this. We'll play a little bit of it. You Say That I'm Crazy.
Yes, that's the next single. It's coming out.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Okay, so this is brand new.
Yeah, we'll this is brand new. No one has heard this.
A little taste.
Everyone
of
on the. You guys are so.
You know what that does? It really matches your kind of the look as well that you have on
Amazing.
Instagram. Because there's lots of bright colours.
Yes.
A pastel, kind yeah. of a merry place, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like this one of this song is very, like, you can imagine. It's a visual song, if that makes sense.
Yes,
like,
yes. Yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, definitely.
No, I've seen your images and everything on social media. Can you describe to people unfamiliar? Because mm-hmm. you're responsible not only for the music, but your own look, styling,
yes.
everything. You have to do everything nowadays.
It's, yeah, I can't afford to get a stylist. I can't afford.
Not yet.
Soon, very soon. So, yeah, definitely. I think I'm just a really, I just love creating. I'm on Pinterest like 24/7. I love it so much. So I just
That's
love...
The visual one, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes,
all imagery
yeah, exactly.
and so on.
I just love just making stuff, and yeah, it's just like a passion. So I'm glad I'm able to actually like do it and like bring my ideas to life.
And you know, I was watching there when we're playing the clip of music,
yeah.
and the traditional Irish thing would be to be mortified by, mm-hmm. oh, it's my thing. Whereas you're part of that generation, both of you now, mm-hmm. aren't you? That are kind of like, no, we're very proud of what we've done. We've got this kind
yeah.
of
I feel like you have
newfound
to be.
Confidence.
You have to be. Yeah. have to be.
We saw it with our stars at the Olympics.
Yeah.
And there was kind of an acceptable swagger.
Instead
of going, oh, yeah. God, I'm so sorry, I'm good at this.
Yeah. No, it's amazing.
And Femi, we asked you, we're going to play Lost Without Maria.
Yes.
Tell us about this
yes.
before I give people a sample of it.
Yes. Do I need an explanation?
Well, I saw online you saying that if you like Frank Ocean or Childish Gambino, this
yes.
is you're going to like what you do, what Femi does.
Yeah. I say this one's more of your kind of like an 80s like pop song.
Oh.
Or something
okay.
like that. It's kind of like, yeah, I say so.
Lost Without Maria. Here's a little bit of it. Yeah, that gives us the idea, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You're enjoying that as well. Dancing around. What is this confidence about? It is a music career. Okay, you're both at it, working extremely hard.
Yes.
Yeah.
Femi, I know you were gigging in Limerick, were you, over the weekend? Or heading to
no.
Limerick and Belfast? Previously. You've
yes.
done those gigs. But is music a career? Is it a realistic career now, a pathway for you?
Yeah.
That's the question.
I've been full-time at it for like... Over a year. So like, yeah, over a year now. So I've been full time. And it's something that, like, that I do, like, vision myself doing, like, for my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's like a short term thing or a hobby.
Yeah.
Especially from last year, I kind of changed from a hobby to, oh, wait, this is kind of like, I'm actually able to kind of live off this.
Wow.
And then now it's kind of flourishing into more things. So I see it as like a lifelong thing.
It may not yeah. just be music. Someone's just WhatsApp saying, can you please ask Femi to set up a YouTube channel reading bedtime stories for grown-ups? What a voice.
Oh,
that's just your speaking voice.
Thank you.
And
thank
two
you.
Superstars, says another. I think it's Marina says
oh,
that
wow.
as well.
Thank
so
you,
go.
Marina.
So you're also confident, aren't you?
I wouldn't even say...
Your family aren't going to let you away with it.
I wouldn't even say I'm confident. Like, for... 2 years I was full-time music, but now it's kind of difficult to be able to like make a living off of just music, so mm-hmm. I am working on the side and just to be able to live and not feel like I'm struggling constantly.
Yeah.
But like the job that I have is in the creative field, kind
yes,
of, so
it's
still aligns. Yeah, it still aligns. So
and in social media, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yep. So it just yeah it aligns and it teaches me stuff as well and how to like promote myself on social media.
Yeah, I like, I'm here on traditional media. We get paid to show up.
Yeah.
You have to put out your content for free. You have to kind of work for free, don't you? And it costs money to create all of this.
So much money. Too much money.
Too much money. TikTok
is important. They're pushing you now at the moment.
Yeah.
But they make money out of content creators. Do you make money out of TikTok, or is that just in America at the moment?
I don't think Ireland has the accessibility
creator
for that.
Fund?
Yeah, creator fund. I think it's just Ireland that just doesn't have it.
Yeah.
In terms of the numbers, is that what you're saying?
No. To apply for it.
It's only TikTok do pay some artists in America, but not currently
not
here.
Not in Ireland.
Yeah. Not here. Despite having their European headquarters here. Maybe we're dropping some hints.
What's going
because,
on? I don't know.
How do TikTok choose you for as a celebration of Black History Month to push you guys? Do you know how that came about, or...?
No.
Magic powers.
Just magic powers.
Just
big
out
company.
There.
Just
chosen one.
Yeah. Someone manager texted me like, "Are you going IT?" I was like,
"So they're using the algorithm to promote you. Is that what they're doing?"
You think? No idea.
I really hope so.
yes, they are.
We love TikTok.
Engagement has gone 100%.
Yes, 100%.
Up.
Yes. Averaging 10 billion views per second.
Honestly, I got 300 billion not too long ago, actually.
Yeah, wow.
The push has been insane.
You know, thank you guys for thank you, honestly.
I feel like a YouTube channel has just been set up. Sarcastic. F.A. and Febby just being sarcastic. Okay, so what's coming up next for you? F.A., you are buzzing for your headline show, which is happening when and where? Tell us.
It is happening in November the 8th in Academy. Amazing venue. I am putting everything into this. I'm going to get set design for it. I'm going crazy. And also in London on the 12th in Colours. So if anyone is heading to London, 12th of November,
that's
going to
be a big week in your life.
Yes, I'm very excited.
I hope the family and Tala are going to it.
Oh, they are not. They're staying home.
How do they expect you to be successful if they don't get tickets for the show?
Don't worry, they'll see when I'm in my Lamborghini, they'll know.
Everybody look up the Academy, 8th of November, that's going to be a good show with F.A. And it's spelled E-F-E-F-A-D-A. Very important. And Femi.
Yes.
This is your plug,
My plug, what I am up to.
You're doing an album, aren't you?
Yes, I am, okay. I'm actually working on
an
album.
I feel like I'm managing you now here.
Yeah, I like this. No,
you're doing an album and the Cork Jazz Festival.
Yes, Cork Jazz Festival. on the Saturday, the 27th, I'll be there.
Yes, that's the October Bank Holiday weekend.
Yes.
Look out for Femi, and you can find you online, F3MIIII, various eyes, and FA is a little easier to find on TikTok and Instagram, Pinterest, everywhere.
Pinterest.
Listen, thank you very much. Happy Black History Month. Is that a thing you can say?
Yes, of course. Happy Black History Month.
We're proud of you.
All year.
Even if your family won't be until you're with Beyonce and the two. One more break before we go. But Femi, while you're still here, that teacher in sixth class was Liam O'Connor. Mr. O'Connor. Trad musician. And people are telling us you've got to play the two tracks in full tomorrow, and kudos to F.A. and Femi, and good luck to you both is what they're saying. And we will find a track and we play, because we didn't have time today, so apologies for that.
But
we
have
Sure, where else would you get it? Aidan Turner can dance, Adrian Childs loves cream crackers, Stanley Tucci hates an Irish actor, and there's a Beyonce judging family in Tala. It's the end of the podcast as you know it. If you have interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, pop us an email anytime at all, Oliver at rte.ie, and happy weekend, everyone. Slán.